Hey, welcome back to a new episode of Skin in the Game. I'm your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim O'Shot.
Tim, you forced me to read another book this past week.
You and I have our own little two-person book club, and this book was a particularly good thing.
Yeah, so Mike Vaccaro just finished the book, The Bosses of the Bronx. Phenomenal read in great detail of the Steinbrenner era, which continues today, of ownership of the New York Yankees, and all the great stories of the Bronx Zoo and the Billy Martin hirings and firings. Can't wait to get Mike onto the show.
Yeah, Mike is the lead sports columnist for the New York Post, which has put him in an incredible position to get the inside scoop on the New York Yankees to develop relationships. So you've got an insider's account that admittedly goes back long before Mike was there. This is a book that goes back to the 1970s when the Steinbrenner, when George Steinbrenner at that point came on the scene. So it's a great insider baseball book. It's a great insider baseball business.
Yeah, so whether you're a fan of the Yankees, whether you're a fan of sports, or whether you're just a fan of the back page of the tabloid.
Especially that.
Yeah, stay tuned with Mike Vaccaro coming up on Skin in the
Game. Even if you're a fan of like the Cleveland Guardians, which John is.
Yes.
You found something you could relate to in this book. We'll save it for the interview. But
brought back a lot of memories. We do have some news to cover, but just real quick when it comes to the Yankees and Major League Baseball. The Yankees, according to Sportico, were just announced the most valuable franchise in Major League Baseball at $9.9 billion.
That almost feels low, but that's me comparing it to an NFL team.
Right. When George Steinbrenner purchased the Yankees in 1972 from CBS, he paid $8.8 million. That's with an M.
You could get like a backup second baseman for that right now.
Yeah, that's right.
You know.
So how times have changed.
Yeah.
And the average value of a Major League Baseball team is just over $3 billion.
That illustrates the power of the New York Yankees. There you go.
That's right. And also kind of some baseball news is the owners of the Broncos, which is owned by the Walton family, Walmart family, just bought 40% equity stake in the Colorado Rockies. So, you're starting to see some changing in the guard of some ownership. You're starting to see some new money kind of getting infused infused into sport. And, people ask me often, why do the values keep going up? And, I think that it really comes down to supply and demand, and the ratings of all sport continue to rise. New revenue streams continue to increase. So, that's really what's driving.
Right. And a team gets sold. And it's just like real estate, right? The house next door to you sells for a sticker-breaking price. Your house value just went up, right?
Exactly.
But in this case, they didn't even have to sell the team. They can just sell a percentage of the team for private equity. And that drives the valuation.
Well,
it's a good deal if you're a sports owner.
It's a good deal for a sports owner. So, Tim, we might have to do a little skin in the game GoFundMe.
What sport do you want? I've asked you this before, but what sport do you want to buy in?
Well, I think we can maybe afford a professional cornhole team.
Yeah, if we really stretch it.
That's about
if
where
we, if we have a record-breaking Kickstarter.
In all seriousness, the sport that's on the rise is our friends at the Professional Women's Hockey League.
Yeah.
I mean, they continue to knock it out of the park, filling up buildings. There's talk of two or three new expansion teams. So professional women's hockey is something we should definitely keep our eye on.
Speaking of hockey, playoff time over in the NHL.
Yes, it is.
What are you seeing? What are you thinking?
Well, I'm seeing a couple things. We're seeing that their success after 14 years of the Buffalo Sabres finally getting back into the playoffs. So that's exciting. North of the border, not as exciting to our friends up in Toronto. They are not going to make the playoffs, and it seems like heads are going to roll up north.
So news on that will probably come a little bit quicker, right as the Buffalo Sabres are trying to finally make something happen in the postseason. There's getting there, which they haven't done in 14 years, and then there's advancing, right? But you used to be the guy in charge of marketing the Sabres, and they were going to the playoffs back when –
And they were one game away from bringing home Sir Stanley. Yes
they were. Mm-hmm. They sure were. So you can relate to this. Here's my question for you. So let's say you're running marketing for the Buffalo Sabres today. Arlie even brought in and out any team that's had a long playoff drought and now they're back in. So maybe eventually the New York Jets, right?
Now they have the longest drought.
Yes,
right.
They do. Yes. They do. You're running marketing for a team that's finally back in the playoffs. It's up to the coach and the players to advance through the playoffs. It's on you to build on that excitement and carry it beyond the season. What are you thinking about? How do you approach that?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we brought this up before. The marketing department or the marketing lead of a professional sports team, their job is to maximize the peaks and minimize the valleys. How do you maximize this peak of interest and demand is you really leverage what I would call season ticket holder priority and new season ticket holder priority for playoff tickets. So if you want to experience the playoffs, great, become a season ticket holder, right? So you really leverage that emotion to drive revenue for next season. If you're our friends in Toronto, you've got to minimize the valley. And that's a matter of communication with season ticket holders, going out of your way from communication to customer service to transparency on what the plan is going forward to hold on to those season ticket holders and let them know that there is a plan. Complete opposites. Again, a team like the Sabres, maximize this opportunity to drive more revenue, primarily season ticket holders. And in the case of Toronto, let's minimize the erosion of our corporate base as well as our season ticket base.
In Toronto, given the hockey market that it is, there will be enough demand.
But also think of Toronto as, you know, they have a soccer team. They have a basketball team. They have the World Cup coming up there. So there's a lot of competition for that entertainment dollar. And I don't believe they do take those dollars for granted. So you've got to keep working on showing value to those sponsors, even if the performance on the ice isn't up to expectations.
Right. Now, speaking of entertaining, we're going to shift our attention back over to George Steinbrenner.
It's baseball season, yes.
It is. And the New York Yankees, 100% on this, there's never been a more entertaining owner in sports than George Steinbrenner.
That's for sure. And what this book with Mike does, it relives some of these stories. You know, when you read them, it's hard to believe they actually happened because it seems like, no, that's fake news. Right. No, this did happen. And George, in many cases, was the catalyst or the instigator, you know, to create the quote unquote Bronx Zoo.
Oh, yeah. He knew how to grab your attention, keep it, shift it, push it forward. It's fun to look back at, probably not fun for the guys who lived it, not always at least, but it's a great read. So we are going to bring in Mike Vaccaro from the New York Post, author of The Bosses of the Bronx. Welcome.
Hey, it's great to be with you guys. How are you guys doing today?
I'm doing better than John because John's a Cleveland baseball fan. And we Mike, get to talk New York baseball
Mike,
today.
First of all,
there you go.
Great book, unbelievable details dating back to the mid-70s. The only problem is I was probably 7-8 years old during those mid-70s when my Cleveland Indians were basically the farm team for the New York Yankees for about 10 years. So thanks for the read, but wow, those were some tough memories for me.
In New York,
thanks for the read. Thanks for the memories, right?
Yeah. You've been doing the rounds here on both on podcasts and radio shows and bookstores,
sure,
all over the place, promoting The Bosses of the Bronx. How would you characterize the reception to the book?
I've been really delighted with it, Tim, to be honest with you. I made the bestseller list its first week out of the box, which was nice. I mean, I was hoping to maybe get there at some point, unexpected to do it right away, happy to do it for the first time in my career as an author. So, I mean, I think that's just a real thrill for me. But beyond that, I mean, just everybody I've talked to seems to have a similar reaction to the one John has, which is that, you know, it's an enjoyable read. It was such a fun book to write, and it's really satisfying to me to hear people say just how much fun they have reading it. You know, it's not a strict biography. I didn't want to write a strict biography, but I did think it was important to go back and talk about a slice of history. You know, the 37 years or so that George owned the team, and then the 15 or so years subsequent after his death. My editor said, write 30 columns, will I make them long? And I said, well, that's a dream come true. Write my column long, I can do that. And so that's really what I tried to do with the book. And I think, I think people have really responded to that way of doing things.
And Mike, how did you get so much data, you know, back to those early 70s? I mean, there are a lot of those sources still around. And how did you compile that data?
Yeah, well, look, I actually did it in three different ways, which is interesting and kind of unique to the project I've done like this in the past. I mean, the first one was like, I've essentially covered the Yankees, or at least been around the Yankees. I was never on the beat, but I've been a columnist in New York and around New York pretty much since 1995. I had a relationship with George going from about 2002 on, although I had talked to him since around 1997 or so. So I had a lot of firsthand reporting. I was around for a lot of it. There were a lot of stories that took place during the dynasty years I was there for. I buried myself in the research, and it's interesting. Other books I've done have had a very heavy like microfilm element to it. And back in those days, not even ancient history, but 15 years ago, what that entailed was, you know, you committed to 3 months worth, where every, you know, 3 days a week, you know, I drive into the city and go to the New York Public Library, the main branch, where they have thousands of complete newspaper archives, certainly all the New York newspaper archives. And you just sit there, you know, in front of stacks of reels of old newspapers. And of course, that's challenging because there's no such thing as a, you know, as a search system or a data system. You just kind of find it on your own, you know. Now you have newspapers.com, the New York Post has archives, the Times has their own archives, the Times Machine. So if you want to, you can pretty much read all the newspapers every day for a period of 37 years, as I did. It's time consuming. It can be a little obsessive, and it was. But I'll tell you what, I never had to leave my house doing that. You know, it's remarkable what you have at your fingertips now. So that was the second element. And look, the third one was, you know, a lot of the people, like I said, I started covering around 95 or so. I wasn't around in the 70s. It was, you know, grade school then. I wasn't around the 80s. I was in college then. I talked to a bunch of, you know, I have many friends in my business, certainly in New York, a lot of mentors in New York. They would tell me a lot of things. But a lot of these guys who were involved, you know, I reached out to them and I said, look, I just want to talk to you on background. I don't expect you to all of a sudden, 40 years later, discover a memory you never had before, you know, like an aha moment. And I know even the guys that went back and forth with George, you know, George was very loyal to those guys. He kept giving them jobs, spring training jobs, Yankees jobs. They weren't going to hammer him. So I just wanted to say, look, just do me a favor. If there's anything any of the stories I want to discuss with you that are wrong or that you know are fundamentally incorrect, you know, please just let me know. Just give me a heads up. You know, and I did that under the safety of anonymity, so they wouldn't have to worry about giving anything up. Just about everybody whose name is in the paper, who's still in the book, rather, who's still alive, I talked to. They're not all quoted in current day quotes, obviously, because I wanted to get the feel of what it was like in those days. So I trust my instincts as a reporter. I use background material and background sources all the time. I rely on my reputation on that. And I've never really come into a problem doing that because I come to it in a good place. So, I guess there's a fourth element, which is that Hal Steinbrenner was very helpful. I mean, I talked to him at length about his father, about himself, about everything, and he was very helpful. So I guess those are the four, like, appropriate enough. It was kind of like the baseball diamond of research for this book.
Sounds like a dream to me. I love it. You know, when we think about George Steinbrenner, and, you know, like John, I grew up, so like so many of our listeners, we grew up, you know, through some or all of his tenure owning the team, and you just hear these stories and you get this impression, and even the name Steinbrenner, as you very eloquently described throughout the book, Mike, evokes emotion, whether it's from a Cleveland fan like John or a New York baseball guy like me. How much urban legend is out there about Steinbrenner, though? I mean, did reporters get it right, or have the stories evolved over the years to where you did find yourself having to clean up the facts and really
honestly,
dig
Tim,
to get it?
That's the most incredible part about this, is that a lot of it, I think, reads like urban myth.
Right.
You know, it reads like urban legend. Yeah. It does. You can't imagine that this one guy had so many layers to him and was involved in so much nutty stuff, right? It doesn't seem real, and yet it's all real. I mean, I know it was real. I mean, you lived through it enough. And, you know, I wasn't a reporter then, but I was a baseball fan in New York in 1977. So I knew all about the Bronx Zoo Yankees, 77, 78. I could have gone on and on for hundreds of more pages. My editor and I agreed that nobody wanted to read the power broker version of George Steinbrenner, right? The power broker, I think, is, you know, weighs in at about 1,300 pages with the index and everything. But I did write 375, and I probably left another 200 pages on the cutting room floor just because, you know, George wasn't primarily involved in these crazy stories, although he was the seed for a lot of them, but he was like a tertiary or even more figure, so that those wound up cut. But there were enough I think what you're left with when you read it is the same thing that you always had when you covered George, is that you realize, I was talking to friends of mine, you know, who cover the Buffalo Bills, and the whole situation when they fired McDermott recently, you know, it just seemed like the greatest meltdown day in Bills history, right? This notable coach is out the door, and you know, what's it gonna be for everybody else? And it's like this seminal moment of, oh my God, everybody can barely catch their breath. That was a Thursday around George Steinbrenner's Yankees. I mean, yeah. You thought it was crazy on Thursday. Well, just wait till Friday. It was going to be different. There's a famous story about Hideki Arabu, you know, on the day that he called him a fat pussy toad and caused like 8 of us writers to go back to the press box and then all of a sudden go into spasm, figuring out how you're supposed to spell the word pussy without being vulgar, right? You can use your imagination there. It's in the book. And I call it one of the great days in American journalism history, because we wound up all having to figure out on our own how to spell the word the way we were all comfortable with and ways our readers were comfortable with. But that's, again, that's just a regular day around the Yankees. But in Steinbrenner's world, that was routine.
I found it fascinating as, you know, kind of a marketing PR guy that, you know, he absolutely, I don't want to say played the media, but really worked the media to make sure.
Definitely that, played along with the media. Definitely yeah, did that.
You know,
sure.
He wanted to be, you know, on the front page or the back page of
or page six. He was fine with page six too. He just liked having his name in the paper.
He just loved it. And, you know, he knew how to give the one-liners or the quips, and he knew how to work the room. And, you know, he was a little bit of Bill Veeck and a little bit of Barnum Bailey and kind of all rolled into one.
That's exactly right. And, you know, people have asked me, you know, what other owners is like him? And I'm like, well, he's really one of one, because I get it. Jerry Jones, you know, he says a lot of silly things. He likes to get involved. I don't think he's ever approached, you know, what Steinbrenner was. And the closest I ever came was to think was Al Davis, who was actually very good friends with George. They were born on the same day, of course, the 4th of July, right? A year apart. You know, he was a New Yorker. And if he'd ever owned the Giants or the Jets, I think he would have been a football version of Steinbrenner. He would have used the back pages to his advantage. But he was in Oakland and even L.A. I mean, that's just not the same as being in a tabloid war. And he took advantage of that because, you know, one of the things he wanted was to make sure that people were talking about the Yankees 365 days a year. And thanks to Steinbrenner, beginning in 1973 and really starting around 76 and 77, it was January, it was December, it was every day, it was a possibility that you were going to find yourself in the middle of a crazy day with the Yankees.
Let's talk a little bit about how the media landscape has evolved during the time frame we're talking about. So you've got George Steinbrenner during the 70s, 80s, 90s, which, you know, if we think about the trajectory of newspapers, you know, I guess we could all, you know, argue or debate when they peaked. But there was something you wrote about in the book that really struck me, which was, you know, some quotes that ended up from a Yankees official in one of the Jersey papers that would have gotten the guy fired if Steinbrenner had seen it in the New York Times, the Daily News, or the Post. But because
it was a
Jersey paper, nobody knew. Well, Steinbrenner didn't care. Either didn't know or didn't care.
Oh, it's a great story. I mean, it's a great story. It's one of the great couple of weeks in Yankees history under Steinbrenner, which was one, you know, Martin basically calls his liar a convicted felon, right? And gets fired for that, finally gets fired for that. Of course, there's a great outcry because Martin was like just this everyman hero in New York, because everybody wants to tell off their boss once in a while, right? And so Yankee fans love that Billy wouldn't just tell off George Steinbrenner, but he'd go on the back page and rip him there too. 2 days later, they're doing a beer commercial together, you know, which is still lives on YouTube, a Miller Lite commercial. 2 days after that, he was brought back to Yankee Stadium and announced as the manager for 2 years hence. So basically, they were going to have Billy, you know, go away for 2 years, disappear, dry out, you know, eat a little bit, get some sun, come back in time for the 1980 season. And so before they sent him away, the writers were all like, we've got to talk to him at least once before he goes. And Steinbrenner didn't want that because he knew what happened when Billy got around the writers. But his PR guy, Mickey Morabito, said, we kind of have to do this. And so Steinbrenner said, all right, well, if he says anything crazy, it's your butt. And Morabito realized he was serious, so they took him to a restaurant. Of course, the writers show up, and Billy's already on his second or third Miller Lite, so he's already primed and ready to go, and he starts basically just tearing into Reggie Jackson, including Fred Chicken Stanley, who I think had a lifetime batting average of .216, maybe hit 15 home runs in the big leagues. You know, Billy Martin's trying to sell that he's a better MVP-type player than Reggie Jackson. Just insane stuff. And of course, the writers are lapping it up. Morabito is about to pass out 7 different times during the lunch because he knows it's going to be for him. Goes back afterward to finally pull in the plug on the lunch and goes to Steinbrenner's office and he says, how'd it go? And he says, honestly, boss, not so great. And Steinbrenner said, well, once I read that tomorrow, pack your boxes. And of course, as an aside, the funny thing is I'm not really talking like Steinbrenner. I'm talking like Larry David talking like Steinbrenner, which is one of the funny side elements of this, right? Nobody really knows anymore what Steinbrenner sounded like, but they know what Larry David sounded like when he was doing his imitation on Seinfeld. But a little after midnight, he got a call from one of the writers. He said, "I'll see you when I see you. We just went on strike." And so there was no Daily News. There was no Post, no Times the next day. You know, in those years, it was all about the New York papers. That's all George cared about, those three papers. And because those three papers didn't exist that day and didn't have any stories, Mickey Morabito kept his job for another year and a half. And that also shows you what kind of impact the New York papers have. Look, there are people right to this day, and this is now 48 years later, who insist that the 78 Yankees were able to recover from being so far behind the Red Sox because the papers are on strike, so they weren't griping at each other every day in the back page. They were able to play baseball.
That, you know, those big New York papers cared about Steinbrenner, that they gave him that kind of attention and coverage.
From Steinbrenner, everything else rolled with the Yankees. Okay, he was responsible for hiring everybody and subsequently firing everybody and then rehiring them again and again and again. He was responsible for assembling the big ticket guys. You know, he tried really to be a responsible owner, even as he was snapping up all these big name free agents early in free agency. He was committing lots of dollars to infrastructure before anybody even knew what that word meant, to farm systems, to paying the best scouts. He realized that you couldn't just survive buying the best players every year. You also had to have a core of regulars to go back to year after year, and it was a smart business plan. The problem is that Steinbrenner shared an office with another Steinbrenner who also happened to be a lunatic Yankees fan. So every time they went on a five-game losing streak, and by the way, as you and I were talking, and the Yankees are on a five-game losing streak, and invariably my inbox is filled with angry Yankee fans who want everybody fired. But that's what George would do. I mean, that guy would be, he had the power to fire people, the power to release people, trade people, and that's what he did. And that's why they spent 18 years without winning a World Series, because a lot of times they would have something good going. They'd go in a little bit of a funk. George would go nuts, and he'd do something like show up in Lou Piniella's office and say, "Hey, I got good news for you, Lou. I just won you the pennant. I just got you Steve Trout." You know, I think Steve Trout had, you know, pitched seven games that year, had like 19 wild pitches, and they didn't win the pennant. But that's what life around George was like. They would not be the Yankees without him and without his insistence that that brand be as strong as it's ever been before. And look, I mean, you can go anywhere in the world, you're going to see people wearing NY hats, right? That's just the way it's going to be. Much to the frustration of my friends who are Mets fans, I mean, you just don't see that a lot. That's why it was an upset when Billy Crystal showed up with a Mets hat in City Slickers, right? Because even he's a Yankee fan, but everybody wears Yankee hats. It's one of the strongest brands in the world in any business, and Steinbrenner realized that, and that's really what was his true genius, was realizing that was something that no matter how bad the ball club was when he first bought it, you know, they weren't going to change the logo and they weren't going to change the history. Nobody could do that.
Yeah, yeah. And Mike, you opened the door on a route I wanted to head down with this conversation.
Sure.
And we're here with Mike Vaccaro, the author of The Bosses of the Bronx. Early in the book, and I do need to relive this memory, you know, Vernon Stouffer, the owner of the Cleveland Indians, did have a handshake agreement for George to buy his hometown team, the Cleveland Indians. That was George's team. That was George's town. And for a number of reasons, Vernon walked away from that deal, and George found this opportunity to buy the Yankees from CBS. I've always wondered, and this is this revised history, you know, how would Cleveland have changed, or the trajectory of the Indians? How would have New York had changed if Vernon Stouffer would have accepted the deal he had with George?
It's a great sliding doors moment that you're not alone in wondering, because the Cleveland Plain Dealer actually devoted like two pages to that very question after my book came out. It's still a question that I think a lot of Cleveland fans ask themselves. He would have done everything he did with the Yankees into Cleveland. And yes, I guess Cleveland didn't have the panache of New York. And sure, George himself was always impressed by New York. He always yearned to succeed in New York. I mean, he was basically the guy that Sinatra was singing about in the song, right? Mm-hmm. But Cleveland mattered to him. The Indians mattered to him. He grew up a fan of that team. He loved that team. His son Hank was like a savant talking about that team in his youth, because his father and he would always talk about Cleveland games. And there's no doubt in my mind that he would have done with Cleveland what he wound up doing with the Yankees, now differently, because there's you know, again, there's no tabloid war to be able to kind of stimulate the conversation day after day after day. But certainly he would have brought the same level of commitment, the same level of mania, if you will. And I think the Indians would have, you know, would have certainly have a different history right now. And I think they probably would have had a, if not a history similar to what the Yankees are, they certainly mm-hmm. would have had something that, where they're not still waiting since 1948 for a championship. I think that's fundamentally what would have been different.
Yeah. Now, Mike, I do need to ask, though, you know, if you're a Clevelander, is Gabe Paul a bit of a villain here? Because he seems awfully like a double agent in this process. Walk us through, walk our listeners through that.
Steinbrenner was introduced to Gabe Paul because he wanted to buy the Indians from Stouffer, like you said. Mm-hmm. Got to know Gabe Paul very well. Paul loved the idea of Steinbrenner, you know, a guy with some resources, a guy with some real ambition, buying the team and giving a chance for him to win for the first time in a very long baseball career. Gabe Paul was friends with Michael Burke, who was CBS's man for the Yankees, and ultimately wound up involved in the group that Steinbrenner put together, and thought he was going to be more involved than he was. That's a whole different chapter mm-hmm. of the book. But Gabe Paul became a part of it. And, you know, Burke thought at the first that it was just going to be, you know, Gabe was going to be an advisor. On the day of the announcement, he shows up, Gabe Paul shows up from Cleveland. All of a sudden he realizes, yeah, he's going to be more than just an advisor. So that wound up hastening Burke's departure from the picture. A lot of what the Yankees built their first teams on were guys who just happened to used to play for the Indians.
Oh,
Chris Chambliss,
like,
and Dick Tedrow. And you know, more tellingly, I mean, the one that's always been a question, and I think Cleveland fans, it's more likely of what you're talking about, something of a double dealing. They traded Greg Nettles about a month before this all happened. So, you know, Nettles was shipped from Cleveland to New York by Gabe Paul to Gabe Paul.
Right.
And that's always been a cornerstone question. Times are simpler then and more innocent, if you will. I think that's probably exactly what happened. I think Paul knew what was coming and he's like, I'd like this player to stay with me and I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be there.
Right.
And so he's going to join me there.
Yeah. It's hard to fathom.
So yeah, I mean, think about Steinbrenner, the rest of his life. I mean, it mattered to him to play well against Cleveland. They had to play well against Cleveland. Later on, it was like Tampa Bay, too, because Tampa Bay became his hometown after a while. But in the most stable situation he ever had was Joe Torre on the job for 12 seasons. But Torre's tenure ended, not surprisingly, or maybe coincidentally, but probably not, because they lost an ALDS series to the Indians, you know? And that wasn't going to fly for George. That was George's last hurrah. A reporter took a chance and called him in his hotel in New York and look, you know, to talk about good fortune, luck of the Irish, he answered the phone. The reporter's name was Ian O'Connor, so he's the one who's always talked about the luck of the Irish. And Steinbrenner said, you know, Joe better win this or else he's gone. And he didn't have the power to make those decisions, but obviously when the boss's opinion was noted, I mean, it was going to be taken seriously. And, you know, there were a lot of reasons why Joe's tenure wound up ending then, but George Steinbrenner's voice, it mattered, and it mattered because he was angry they were losing to Cleveland, and that was never a good idea for any manager or any team that played for Steinbrenner.
Mike, in what ways did George Steinbrenner impact the way other owners in and out of baseball have conducted themselves?
I don't think anybody's ever really modeled themselves over his flamboyant, over-the-top behavior. I mean, Jerry Jones, like we said earlier, has tried, but that's really a triple A version of George. Let's be very honest. You know, Mark Cuban used to give press conferences from his exercise bike, which I guess is different, but that's not exactly going to sell a lot of papers. Right. Davis was the closest. I mean, look, he would say whatever he wanted, but you know, Steinbrenner was, you know, represented an era when people still weren't worried about, you know, I won't say misbehaving, but say, speaking their mind publicly, because no, you know, there weren't people with a cell phone ready to click them right with a photo. I mean, I think nowadays owners are raised to be very careful with what they say. They know that what they say is going to be forever, and so they're a lot more close to the vest. And look, even the preponderance of guys in Steinbrenner's time didn't want to act that way because, you know, they feel like they got rich for a reason. They did it kind of in the shadows without anybody paying a lot of attention to them. And a lot of those guys just cared about being rich, not necessarily being famous. George liked being rich and famous. That's why New York was kind of the perfect destination for him. It was really the only destination for him. You know, he used to fly into New York 100 times when he was in Cleveland, you know, sitting in a middle seat, you know, in the middle of the plane. And he always said, one of these days, I'm going to fly first class into LaGuardia. And of course, later in his life, he took thousands of flights on his own jet into his own private airport. And, you know, he always dreamed of getting a good table of 21.
Yeah.
Because whenever he was in Cleveland, he'd fly into New York and his secretary would always be told, give me a table of 21. And the best you could do is always, you know, the second floor at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Of course, by the end, George could rent out the whole restaurant if he wanted to, and they would have done whatever he wanted. So he understood, as well as Reggie Jackson did, how powerful New York could be for your ego and for your reputation. And both men played that to the hilt.
You know, Mike, you bring up these characters and these individual owners. And, you know, and George had a smaller percentage, but he had a managing role. Tim and I, we talk a lot about in today's sports, you know, we're losing some of those characters, like them or yeah. not, you know, as we start to see private equity ownership, right? And less family ownership, less community ownership. I think that's a shame. I think, you know, while, again, love them or hate them, you know, Charlie O'Finley and Al Davis and George Steinbrenner, you know, they're part of the entertainment value around sports. And, you know, what we're starting to see is private equity creeping in. And they're seeing it in Fenway right now. I mean, they're calling, you know, for Fenway Sports Group to private equity to sell the Red Sox. So you're starting to lose right. some of that. And I just would like, you know, your thought. Are you kind of seeing that change of the guard? And does it concern you?
It saddens me. It's the same way it saddens you, because, mm-hmm. You know, the Dodgers are a great team. And when you want to credit somebody at the top of the corporate ladder, you got to start, you know, with the A's and go on to the Z's, because there's a million people involved because it's a corporation. It's just different. You know, the Dodgers are always the O'Malley's, right?
Right.
And of course, it's been a while since the O'Malley's were involved, but you could always name a family to a prominent team, right? And that's what Steinbrenner was. And it's interesting, because really that's what Steinbrenner rescued the Yankees from, because that's really what CBS was. Part of the reason why the Yankees were so slipshod from 64 to 74 is because there was nobody really to blame. I mean, Michael Burke was ostensibly in charge, but he was just a CBS employee. You know, and Bill Paley had, you know, he was caring more about All in the Family, I Love Lucy, and the Beverly Hillbillies than he was about the Yankees. So it's interesting. I mean, yeah. That's what almost caused the downfall of the Yankees, because there wasn't an invested family who had local ties and just desperately felt the need to make the Yankees successful. And that's what Steinbrenner, that's why he was greeted with such a breath of fresh air. You know, Larry Merchant, the great columnist who's you know, job, whose place in the paper I now have the great privilege to occupy at the Post. You know, when Steinbrenner wrote it, he said, well, the Woodstock Nation's come to the Yankees, which is hilarious, thinking about George Steinbrenner listening to Canned Heat in the Mud up in Woodstock. But the point was, it was a younger, fresher voice as opposed to what they had with CBS. Now everybody is CBS on steroids, right? I mean, like the Blue Jays are that way. The Blue Jays are owned by the Rogers Corporation. Right. I mean, again, it's the corporation. It's getting harder and harder to afford a baseball team, any sports team. We're talking about billion-dollar entities. And no matter how prosperous times are in this country, there's only a certain amount of billionaires who can afford to buy a team. It's going to be more and more situations like the Dodgers, where it's going to be corporations that have deep pockets and kind of figure it out from there. Steve Cohen owns the Mets now, and he's not, you know, he's kind of his own one-man monolith at the corporation, because he's worth $23, $24 billion. That was different than what George had coming up, by the way. That's right. One difference between him and Hal. I mean, you know, when you know, George took the town back from the Mets, and by the time he was able to really kind of stick it to them, you know, they were owned by a nice lady named Lorinda D. Relay. But, you know, Drew Relay's thing was to ask her people if they could, you know, bring foul balls back from the stands so they could wash them off and use them the next day. Steve Cohen's not going to do that. So that's what Hal's going up against. You know, George never had someone like that in his own market, let alone the corporations that they have elsewhere in the places I mentioned. And that's becoming more and more a part of sports. And it's just added to the list of all the things about sports that are just, we accept as reality now, that, you know, just weren't so 10, 15, 20 years ago, whether it's NIL in sports, whether it's corporate ownership throughout the franchise picture. I mean, it's a changing landscape, and it's almost like they challenge you more and more as a fan, whether you want to really stick around or not.
Mike, I'm curious too about the Yankees' impact on sports economics, and again in baseball, but also looking beyond baseball too, you know, in The Bosses of the Bronx, you write in detail about the way Steinbrenner reacted, you know, quite gleefully to free agency and being able to use his resources in his city, New York, to lure guys in, right? It feels like baseball really drove a trend here for a while, and Steinbrenner would have been at the front of that. So, you know, what's your take on his impact and the Yankees' impact on that?
Yeah, for sure. Look, he saw free agency for the opportunity it was. He knew that Gaypole had already built a nice team for him, but that nice team had also gotten swept 4 games by the Cincinnati Reds. So he knew he needed some immediate infusion of star power, and that's when Reggie Jackson showed up. And that was the most important transaction in the Steinbrenner years, because really from there, everything that happened later on was built on the template of what he did with Reggie. Paid him a lot of money, not the most money, but a lot of money. Basically rolled the carpet out to New York City and said, you know, have at it. But one thing I think is interesting, you talk about the economics of the game, right? In 77, Steinbrenner built a team that was dubbed the best team money could buy because, had all these glamorous players on it, Catfish and Thurman and Reggie. And it cost a total of $3 million. And we can laugh at that total the way we laugh at thinking that milk once cost a nickel and that bread once cost a dime. But even if you take that money and you translate it to $2,026, it's about $16, $17 million. And that's what they're going to pay Gerrit Cole before he ever throws a pitch this year. The economics are so different. And yes, you can say that baseball makes more money now too, but you're talking about just staggering totals now. When George had to talk to his partners, and like Hal, George had partners and he had to talk to them. Now, George was the managing general partner, as is Hal, so they have final say, but they better build a consensus or else they're not going to have that job for long. And the fact of the matter is that his partners are complaining about not getting a dividend for a couple of years. And he'd say, look, just enjoy your expensive season ticket. That's what this is. Enjoy it and let's move on. Hal can't be that glib with his partners when he's basically talking to them about the possibility of possibly signing a player for $750 million. And, you can tell me how many billions of dollars the Yankees generate in revenue every year. That's still a lot of money, and relative to what they're bringing in. And so those are different conversations. It's a different economics in the sport now. And look, that's what the sport as a whole, the reckoning it's facing soon, because George took advantage of the fact that not everybody could be the Yankees. Now, of course, the Yankees are wondering if they can ever be the Dodgers again, just in terms of economic might, because that's just what the Dodgers are capable of. And the duality of being an owner of the Yankees now, Hal Steinbrenner just mentions the fact that it's a different kind of time now when you're a family business going up against the Dodgers, who are not, and people want to just crucify him for crime poverty and for showing that as an example of he's not really committed. Well, I'd say he's pot committed. I mean, it's a fifth year in a row, I think, where they've had $300 million payroll. I mean, they're not spending less. Right. If anything, they're right alongside the arms race with the Mets, the Dodgers, the Cubs, and everybody else. I think if you had told George Steinbrenner in 1978 that one of these years his $3 million payroll would be $300 million, he would have said, no way, son, that's just not going to happen. Yeah. But, thanks to him, it's happened.
Yeah. Well, George often, as a marketing guy, what I appreciated about George is, he was also focused on butts and seats, right? So this was about, yes, Reggie's going to win us games, but Reggie's also going to sell us tickets. And he was... And throughout your book, Mike, it just, George is very focused on spending money to make money, right? And I think that's a different perspective. And he was focused on the ROI, what I'm trying to say there.
Right. To me, one of the more enlightening moments in the book, because it's one of the more informative moments in the Steinbrenner era history, was the day after the 76 World Series. I mentioned earlier, the Reds, the big red machine, stomped the Yankees, embarrassed the Yankees. The Yankees didn't belong on the same field with them. Everybody knew it. I mean, it was just a blowout of historic proportions. The Yankees weren't used to getting swept in series their entire history. They were the ones who did the sweeping. That really stung, and it really rankled Steinbrenner. And in that, it's almost those 4 games almost did away with the whole season that went before it, because the very next day, he called all of his lieutenants to his office at Yankee Stadium, Gaypole, Billy Martin, all the important scouts. They said, all right, what are we going to do now? And, Gaypole said, I think we need to get Bobby Gritch, another free agent. He's exactly what we need. A versatile infielder. He can play some second base, play some shortstop. We can use a shortstop. That's our guy. Billy Martin said, no, it's Joe Rudy. Joe Rudy's the guy we need. And Joe Rudy was a fine player, an all-star, teammates with Reggie Jackson, but he was a secondary or tertiary player on some very good A's teams. He could run a little bit, throw a little bit, hit a little bit, but was never going to blow you away. And George listened to all these opinions, and he nodded his head and said, well, what about Reggie? And, of course, in that moment, all of his lieutenants realized that that wasn't really a question. It was, well, we're getting Reggie. And they would give their cases about on-base percentage and fielding percentage. And George would say, that's all fine and well and good, but Reggie's going to put fannies in the stands. And those guys won't put fannies in the stands. That was his quote, fannies in the stands. And he was right, and a couple months later, he closed the deal with Reggie, and they had 5 productive and very, very loud years together.
Mike, several times during the Steinbrenner tenure, as you know, Major League Baseball players went on strike.
Yep.
I mean, if we go back, 1994, 1995 comes to mind. Talk us through how Steinbrenner looked at that, because you got me thinking there when you're saying, how would he have reacted? I wonder how he would have reacted to a $300 million payroll. And here these guys were striking when, you know, pay was nowhere near that scale.
He was always very much of a reluctant participant in the ownership side of it, because he realized that if there were constraints placed on payroll, it wasn't just the players who were going to suffer, it was the Yankees that was going to suffer. So he would, you know, he never actually broke with them, but he was never what you would call an out in front guy who served as a voice for the owners. And in fact, a couple of times tried to break with them. And it's interesting, it happened a lot of different times. There was a strike in 72, which was just before Steinbrenner got the team. So there was a lot of talk there. 76, he was due to come back from suspension whenever spring training opened. And spring training opened on March 1st, but there was a lockout. So he came back to no baseball team. In 81, he was the same way. He really wanted this thing to go a couple of weeks and let's just be done with it. And his owners, the other owners, were a little more stubborn. They lost 70 games of the season. And 94 was the same thing. Look, I mean, he had just come back from another suspension. The Yankees were finally a contender again when the strike came in 94. It was them and the Expos who were the clear two best teams in baseball, likely would have met in the World Series. And because there was no World Series, that season basically didn't ever happen. It vanished into thin air. You know, he encouraged other players to utilize facilities near their spring training headquarters in Fort Lauderdale so they'd be able to kind of get him there right away. But again, there was a lot of self-interest involved there. And he was the guy who held the hammer. You know, Hal doesn't hold that hammer anymore. The Dodgers hold the hammer now. If they want to you know, represent ownership, you know, the interest of maintaining this economic system. I think Hal is smart enough to say that he's not going to line up with the Pittsburgh Pirates because no one's going to buy that. But theoretically, I mean, I think it's more the key. They're in some ways closer in philosophy now to the small market teams into the big ones, only because while New York is a big market, you know, what the Dodgers and the Blue Jays have isn't really contained to market. It's contained to endless resources, which could be anywhere. I mean, it could be the Guam Blue Jays, but as long as you're going to put that many resources into the product, you're going to have the same difficulties for other people in the sport.
Well, I just, Mike, need to correct you, though, on 94, 95. If you recall, that was the Cleveland Indians team with Albert Bell, Jim Thome, Kenny Lofton. We were on the cusp as well.
Yeah, you were. I mean, on the cusp. No, on the cusp. 95 is when they went 144 and they clearly ascended. But even in 94, the Yankees had a better record than the Indians going into the it wasn't just a two horse race. You're right about that. I was not disrespecting Albert Bell because I would never want him to hear me say that.
Yeah, no, we do have a contingent of Northeast Ohio listeners, so I didn't want to be catching their wrath for not at least
I don't want that either. I want them buying the book. So I definitely, I'm definitely go Indians, go Guardians.
Which, by the way, on that note, you know, just to give a plug, you know, even if you are not a Yankees fan, it is a great read. It's so much history, which is really so relevant to today's game and what we're seeing. It's, you know, yeah. So, Mike, whether you're a Yankee fan or not, if you're a fan of history of the game or just, you know, a history of characters in sport and entertainment, it's well worth the read or the listen.
Well, so, Mike, we appreciate having you. I'm going to slip in one last question before we go.
Of course.
Hal Steinbrenner's in charge today. What are the influences you still see of George when you look at the Yankees franchise now?
Well, look, Hal is completely different than his father, you know, in the way that my father could fix everything and play everything musically, and I can do none of the above. Sometimes sons are just different than their fathers, and Hal is very much different than George. And George wanted it that way. Look, George spied Hal as the guy before anybody else did, because he just thought he was a sharp, smart guy, and he's turned out to be very much that. He doesn't find it to be burdensome to be Steinbrenner's son or to own the Yankees. In fact, the word he always uses is privilege. It's a privilege to have been his son. It's a privilege to be in charge of this great civic trust that the Yankees are in New York. So from that, you know, George's spirit and his legacy is still very, very present in the current owner. Hal is also very different, and he makes no bones about how different he is. I mean, he talks about himself being a backroom guy while his father was the back page guy.
Right.
And tellingly, he told me this story, and invariably people get a kick out of this story because it's true. I mean, as most of the, non-urban myths in the book are, he says, people don't think I care. Of course, nothing rankles Hal more than people think that he doesn't care. He cares, trust me. I've watched the man celebrate after a pennant. I've seen him suffer after season's ends. He cares. You don't invest all that much of your family's time and fortune, without caring. But what he says is, I'll watch a game on TV and the Yankees will make an error in the ninth inning and we'll lose. And I'll throw my shoe at the TV. You bet I will. He said, now, my father, he would see the Yankees lose a game, make an error in the ninth inning, throw his shoe at the TV, and then he'd pick up the phone and he'd call Dick Young or Phil Pepe or Murray Chass and say, guess what I just did? I just threw my shoe at the TV. And suddenly there'd be three days of back pages and headlines, and that's something you're never going to see Hal do. George would generate his own back page wars. Hal's never going to do that. I still think the New York Post back page has a large impact. You see people, lifted up on TV all the time if there's a clever headline. But the fact is that we don't really have anybody that we're going against. The Daily News has diminished, sadly, to what it used to be. So there's no real tabloid war now. And times are different, People ask me how George Steinbrenner would have adjusted to social media. And I tell him, well, you would have seen him all the time like this. He'd be on his phone and he'd be tweeting. And look, for better or worse, one guy who looked at every move George made for many, many years. And if you close your eyes after reading some of the quotes in this book and you just study the cadence, one guy who studied the George Steinbrenner playbook to a T was the guy who's in the White House right now. Trump was always a close friend of Steinbrenner's. He was always in his box. And he thought that Steinbrenner had the right blueprint for how to get your point across loudly, always clearly, sometimes incorrectly, sometimes not so well. But he didn't care. He just moved on. He learned that from George, because George would just say something on Tuesday, something else on Thursday, and you forgot what he said on Tuesday.
I have a notebook here in front of me, and I wrote the word Trump. Like, this is like Trump. And I was thinking that when I was reading the book. And
it was no accident. Yeah. It's no accident. Forgetting politics and everything else, there's no question that just in terms of his public persona, Donald Trump studied George Steinbrenner and said, I want to do it that way. And he did.
Wilson, the book is great. We are so happy to have you here. So Mike Vaccaro, author of The Bosses of the Bronx, thank you for being here.
Thanks, guys. It's been a lot of fun talking about this, and I really appreciate it. I really do.
Thanks, Mike. I look forward to catching up soon. Thank you. Tim, thanks for bringing Mike on board. I guess he's got a connection.
He's a Bonaventure guy. We did not overlap at Bonaventure, but we had the same mentor, the longtime sports editor of the Olean Times-Herald, Chuck Pollack. Gave a lot of people their starts. I was one of them. Mike is one of his headliners.
So I thought you were the most famous journalist alumnus to come out of St. Bonaventure.
Well, did you?
I did.
We need to teach you a lot about St. Bonaventure. You might know a guy named Woj.
Yeah. But no, what a great conversation with Mike. And I, in all sincerity, I'm a baseball fan, but I'm not a Yankees fan.
Right,
matter of fact,
right.
They stole many of my players. They stole a few of our championships or our playoffs. But great read, the history of the game, the characters of the game. And unfortunately, you're seeing less and less of this. And part of it is the overabundance of social media and quote unquote fake news that, owners and ownership spokespeople are afraid to be out there. But private equity is also part of that. And, Mike brought up a term, civic trust, right? So if you look at the Dolan family in Cleveland, if you look at the Hunt family with the Chiefs, go on and on. These are family investments, but it's really a civic investment, right? And they're tied to the community. As we start to see private equity come into the mix, it's not a civic trust. It's
no,
a business.
You do, just across sports, see that private equity and corporate ownership
right.
creeping up. And yeah, that Dodgers or Blue Jays versus Yankees, not necessarily on the field, it could be on the field, but off the field for money and resources, that's a very interesting change of today versus like how Steinbrenner just dominated in the 70s and 80s.
Interestingly, George Steinbrenner arguably bought the team from private equity, or in this case, a corporation.
Yeah, CBS.
CBS, who, you know, was less worried about butts in seats, was less worried about, you know, community involvement. You know, they were in it for content, right?
Right.
How do they
right.
have lead-in programming to 60 Minutes?
Right, right.
So different priorities. And, you know, it's, again, nothing you and I sitting here today can do to change it. I just think for us and all of our listeners, it's important to know that times are a-changing.
I wonder, too, what it's like to be working or playing for a sports franchise when it's owned by a family versus when it's owned by a corporation. Because being part of a family business, even a very high-profile, high-revenue one like a sports team, you are serving the vision of a family,
right?
Versus you are making money for a corporation.
Yeah,
nothing
yeah.
wrong with the second thing, but the first thing would have a very different feel when you're marketing it, when you're choosing whether to stay there, you know, or whether to move on. I have so many memories of football players, and in my case, and hockey players talking to me about the owner walking in after the game up to the locker to say, "Hey, good game," or "How are you doing?" Or Terry Pegula seeing Josh Allen crying after the last game and turning around and, you know, in part because of that, firing his head coach. Obviously,
right.
much more to it, but that's an owner making a decision for his family business.
Right.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to argue with the Pegulas or anyone else saying it is a family business, or the Steinbrenners for that matter, but I think it's more, and the owners I've worked for said, we're caretakers of this business.
It would be interesting to see, you know, if owners would agree with that. This is a community asset versus this is mine.
Yeah.
It makes me wonder what Steinbrenner thinks about it. Apparently Hale Steinbrenner, to Mike's point, looks at it as the Yankees are, you know, a civic asset, and our family's in this position to own and lead and be the caretakers of it. Right.
Right.
That's kind of what I took away from the book and our,
mm-hmm.
our conversation
yeah.
with
yeah.
Mike,
yeah.
how prevalent that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, I was very fortunate in my career to work for the families that owned the teams. Right. And they were very involved in decisions, not as involved as George was.
yeah, it's hard to match that.
But they took it personal, and they also really focused on, you know, the importance that that asset is to the community at a whole. So, you know, let's hope that as private equity continues to come into professional sport, that there's still someone overseeing and caretaking that brand and caretaking what that brand means to the community.
There's a point you made during our conversation with Mike that I really appreciate, which is some of these owners are such characters. They are a part of the game. They are part of what keeps fans engaged and entertained. And yes, that was Al Davis. It was 1,000,000% George Steinbrenner. I think it was Mark Cuban, you know, with the Mavericks.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it definitely is that yeah. guy in Dallas. What's his name?
Oh, yeah, with Jerry something. No, I mean, Jerry, I've been around, I have a story yeah. watching Jerry Jones, the Buffalo News reporter, and I were walking after him to talk to him in New York City. Jason Wolf, my friend from formerly from the Buffalo News, had to elbow a TMZ guy, a paparazzi, to get in between that guy and Jones to talk to him. I mean, that's what kind of celebrities owners can be.
Right.
But
right.
nobody, I don't think anyone ever more than George Steinbrenner.
No, he's one of a kind. The mold has been broken, but I do thank Mike Vaccaro for bringing that character and telling those stories, you know, back into his book. The Bosses of the Bronx, Yankee fan, or in my case, not, it's well worth the read.
It's a great baseball book, and you and I both love a great baseball book.
Yeah. Wait, thanks again for tuning in. We'll see everybody next week. Skin in the Game is a production of Buffalo, Toronto Public Media. You can catch up with all past episodes on btpm.org or at the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel. Thanks for listening.